Accession number 31048, Rule 3.
Yes. I've talked, born and brought up, or it was in the East End. Personality was a sense of fun, great sense of fun. They all had a sense of fun with each other, like they sort of ring each other up and say, Crystal Palace was on fire. Yeah, well, it can't be, it's only steel and glass. And of course, he was rung up one day and he just got home and was told the Crystal Palace was on fire, and he put the phone down. Oh, don't be bloody silly, put the phone down. You know, they would sort of play those practical jokes on each other. In Fleet Street, you know, great sort of for pulling. But his interests were mainly interests around my mother and the home and myself. I mean, it was very much a sanctuary. Because when you're hearing around, whether you're chasing down to the south of France to get a picture of Edward VIII, remember, driving down to the south of France in a car in 1936 was quite an event, really. And one of the things I have here that I brought with me today is a leaflet that was sold with the Daily Herald of the Spanish Civil War, which is, there's a piece by Attlee in it, a piece by Philip Noel Baker and Ellen Wilkinson, and it's pictures taken of kids with on crutches, or you know, the horrors of Spain with their Civil War. And in fact, the picture, it says 13 photographs taken for the Daily Herald by E.G. Mallinder. Now, I remember after the war, when the 1948-49, when it sort of hardened against the Russians and the Cold War really got underway, and all the fellow travellers and a bit of McCarthyism that sort of crept in even here. And on that visit, although it's not in this, where was a picture of Attlee doing the communist salute, and that created quite a fuss in Parliament in sort of, you know, the late 40s, as you can imagine. So, you know, there's a lot of, so I think it was R&R almost when you got home, enjoy a bit of gardening and sort of the house and seeing friends. Relationship with brother Bill, not much. His brother was 9 years younger than him. So when my father was 40, well, you know, when my father was 9, 10, he had this squawking brat in the house. Then he went away for 2 years to Arding Lie, came back and was working, and there was no relationship. They got on because they were brothers, but there was nothing closer than that. My mother made a comment to me, and I don't quite know the justice for this, and my uncle a misjustice, I'm sorry, but she did make a comment that sort of, oh well, he only got where he got because he was on Dad's back. May or may not be true, I know not. Certainly during the war, Brother Bill was out in Cairo setting up darkroom facilities there. I don't know what papers he worked on or what press he worked on before the war. Certainly after the war he went to the Daily Mirror and became their crime photographer. I mean, I can remember going to see him and he would tell us, I mean, like all the press now, they get information from the police about whatever the crime was at the time, things that hadn't been published, you know. Okay, early influences. I think one of the earliest influences was against drink. Brought up in a pub in the East End of London where drink was an escape for a lot of people. And he said to me, he never liked what he saw it did to people who couldn't afford to spend the money to do that. And it was lining his parents' pockets. And, you know, make no bones about it, his parents were very successful publicans. And she lived from 1940, she left the pub in 1944, and lived off her income, not much left when she died. It died in 1960, so she died and lived 20 years with nothing else other than what she'd made out of the pub. Did they ever work together before World War II? No. Highlights and lowlights of pre-war career? I don't know of a lowlight. I think before the war, everything was very much, he was very much a blue-eyed boy. We've got some letters of compliments about some of his work from Daily Herald personnel, senior personnel. I think things were quite good all in all.
Would you be able to talk a bit more about how he actually came to have an interest in photography and how he loved
it? No, I couldn't tell you that at all. All I know is that he was apprenticed in the dark rooms in Fleet Street. I don't know through whom, why. I never asked. But obviously once he got into it, he was utterly and completely hooked in the composition of pictures. I mean, he wasn't a particular... If I say he wasn't artistic, he wouldn't go to the Louvre or National Gallery and say, oh, that's good, isn't it? You know, or any painting or anything like that. Wouldn't necessarily go to a stately home because that's fantastic. Look at that ceiling. It's an Adam ceiling or whatever it might be. But yet if he went there with a camera, he'd pull something out of it. Interesting. You know, if the camera was in the hand, he could bring some life out.
I think it must have captivated him because of that appalling record of 8-9 jobs. You know, he was obviously totally...
And he never changed. I mean, he might have changed companies, but from the time he was in there, he was locked into photography, full stop, nothing else. And I mean, Linda's instance in that booklet we've got there, that at the time of the general strike, he roller skated from Bethnal Green to Fleet Street. And if you come down Luggett Hill, in those days, and I can remember a policeman standing on a box in the middle directing the traffic, for they had traffic lights there, and he couldn't stop coming down Luggett Hill and copped it from the police, a policeman on duty on the other side, because he went straight across.
I think he internalised photography totally. Yeah. I mean, I think whenever he looked at something, he saw it through a lens.
I'm oh, absolutely certain of that. I mean, we've got photographs. Before I came today, I sort of looked at a lot of photographs. After the war, when we went on holidays to Switzerland and things like that, we would stop. We were very lucky. We had a car, 1949. Very few people did in the UK in those days. We had a new car. So he used that as a photographic record of our holiday, positioning the car and selling the photographs on to Vauxhall. It was a Vauxhall car. And they used some of the photographs for their sort of publicity and point of sale material. There's one in Switzerland at the top of the Gotthard Pass or whatever it might be. And so he used, but he, as Linda said, he did see everything through a viewfinder.
If you took a photograph, he would put it to pieces.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, he'd be highly critical. Look at it and say, we had a row. What do you mean, Dad? We're so bloody far away, you can't see the person you're photographing. He liked to have something close in the foreground, whether it be something like a tree framing or thing, or like those German officers waiting to surrender, the inside of their car framing things. If you're taking a view, get a tree or a person in the foreground that frames the picture and gives it depth and focus. And the other one was his other expression, which I'll give you for the tape. He'd look at it and say, full of teeny-weenies, isn't it? Teeny-weenies, Dad? What are they? Teeny-weeny little bits of shit. You're so far away from everything. And, you know, that was him saying to me, well, if you want to photograph something, get them on close. Don't have them so far away that you can't see what they're looking like.
Did you find then he had a particular position on the balance between the picture as a form, as you've been talking about, and the picture just as a conduit to...
Oh, I think the picture was always tried to be formed. I mean, obviously, if it's, say, a state procession coming round or a royal funeral and it goes round the corner, well, you've got a short period that it's there in front of you. And then it's gone, and you're in a set position. But would always try to to make it a form, rather like you've got that one of the bell ringers that we're just Linda's holding up now, so that you can get the atmosphere out of that. I mean, you've got atmosphere in that photograph.
He's very shrewd. He would always he would take the opportunity if he could see a commercial opportunity.
Yes.
He
would
take that.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. I think the interesting thing, and doing what we've been doing over the last couple of years, really, is realizing what a hell of a life he had, what a hell of a life experience he had, and it was, don't get me wrong, I'm not being rude, just as normal as you interviewing me today. Your work, his work, and didn't see it as a part of history. I don't want to talk about Belson. And the other interesting thing about sort of nasty things happening in the war, I'm sure you must have heard this, taking sound archives, is that so many Americans I have taken around the beaches, especially Omaha, they all say that, well, my dad was there or my uncle was there, and it wasn't until the last week of his life that he talked about it. And I think that's the way it was, that so many people just pulled the shutters down, don't want to remember it, and only spoke very late on. Pushed it to one side.
I think my other feeling, if you actually look at the amount of travelling he did right up until the 50s, I think he had a bit of burnout after.
I'm certain. And after,
you can't keep travelling all over the world.
After the war, I saw less of my father than during the war. I mean, I was lucky because many of my school friends had their father in India or Burma, and last from 1940 and didn't see them until the end of 1945. My father was based, if I say broadly, at home in London. Okay, he would go away and then he popped back again. I never knew what he was doing. And there's a question here that Hillary's got about some of his secret photography that he did for photography for the intelligence services, i.e. Extent and Nature. I only know what I have seen on your website, except one thing, and that was he told me that he photographed the sea being set on fire in England, he didn't say the date, but being set on fire, anti-invasion, and it was never published. And it was never published because if we could do it, the Germans could do it, and we had to land on another beach again. That's the only comment that he made that I will call under sort of that intelligence services secret work. Anything else, he never mentioned after the war even. And there's another question of Hillary's, which was censorship, experience of and influence on. Being competitive, as Linda and I have said, he absolutely hated the censorship and the Ministry of Information because everything he took had to go for censor. And if he was standing with an American on his right shoulder taking the same photograph, the American's photograph would be in the papers in Fleet Street before the Ministry of Information had released it for Fleet Street, because the American would get it to the States and the States would send it back and used by the press in the UK, although it hadn't been cleared by the Ministry of Info. And that used to make him wild. He used the term that Hollywood went to war. And he was very carping of the quality of the cameras that they had, especially the cine cameras. And I think when you look at the cine cameras that AFPU people had, compared with what the Americans were using, Hollywood did go to war. And that's why, no disrespect to those guys, the majority of the war footage, especially of Normandy campaign, is American, because the quality of the work that the cameras they were using was far superior to what our guys had, which was pretty rough.
Did he have an opinion as to, I think Hillary might have mentioned this somewhere, but as to his function and role as an army photographer, and whether he was being used as a sort of tool of the army to tell a story? That
never mentioned that. It was a job. I don't think people were quite as cynical as they are today about being used by politicians for telling a story. I mean, I think an awful lot of things were used, certain pictures were used. I mean, obviously the Belsen pictures, the Germans were made to walk past them in the local town, and they all said, well, it didn't take out their propaganda pictures. But I don't think people were as cynical or used things as cynically then as perhaps they do now.
Never
talked in that way. I mean, there's a picture in those ones of the liberation of Paris, of which there were two British jeeps, AFPU jeeps, and one of them is taken, the one in front going up the Champs-Élysées, with the Union Jack on the back of the lead jeep. And you can see the caption that could have been used. British in Paris. Not even taken Paris, but the influence of the British, you know. And that sort of thing, I think, is likely to be used more today than it probably was then. I'm only thinking of what Hillary said to us when we were up at the IWM in Manchester, about what photographers, what they can compose of photographs today and the restrictions that they have. My father would hate that. Would have hated that.
Did he talk much about the sort of day-to-day operations of a photographer in the field, as well, with a unit, and how things would be organised and operated?
No, not to me. You know, there were odd bits about, that was bloody miserable, it rained all day, or things were just not good. Sat there and was mortared for umpteen days. No, not really. I mean, the main concern was, I've got some photographs, I want to get them back, and I want to get them printed, and I want to get them released through the M of I. No. I, from his point of view, compared with a lot of other guys who are in the services, he probably had the ability to get home more often than others, because there was the reason to come back to London for something or other. And we were talking, coming over the other day. Certainly he was home for Christmas 1944. Because I remember I had a Jeep given to me as a Christmas present, and Dad being there. And in February, March 1945, the whole school had gone down with chicken pox. I was the last to get it. And he and my mother came up to North Wales to see me there. Now, you know, he was in Northwest Europe at that time, and came back to see me on the fag end of my chicken pox. And I can remember that. And as I said earlier, I didn't have... He went away, and he was a stranger to me in 1945-46, because he'd been backwards and forwards. But after the war, one year after the war, we've got a list of how many in there of how many countries he visited. He flew to Singapore, and it took 7 days and seven nights by flying boat. You take off from Hearn, in the water there, and you put down in Brindisi and have a night in a hotel. You put down the next night somewhere on the Nile. You put down the next night somewhere in the Gulf, then across to Karachi, then across to Rangoon, and then down to Singapore. You know, and that was 47, because he was there prior to Indian independence, all in that area. So, I mean, you know, the sort of travelling that he did was...
Well, I think that showed during the 60s and 70s. So it always sort of struck me as...
Tired.
Tired would be the word I would use.
Tired, yes. Yes, he was not the healthiest of people. And he certainly knew that his time was up. I think the last photographic job he did, he may have photographed Tessa and Jeremy after that, but he did some photography for me, for my company, and we went out to lunch together, and he actually talked to me very much sort of father to son and man to man, you know, sort of. Didn't say I haven't got long to go, but whatever happens, look after Mum. You must promise me that. So I think he knew. Smoked heavily, 60, 80 a day, as they all did in Fleet Street in those days.
You felt the weight of that camera you used to carry around.
Yeah, I mean, and I tell you what, the stroboscopic flashes after the war, I can remember them. They were big, huge lumps of kit with the batteries, and they had to be charged and all the rest of it. Unbelievably heavy. Yes, I mean, that camera box with 2 dozen glass plates in it.
What was his attitude towards the sort of photographic technological development?
Well, he himself, I think, was essentially a pressman and liked everything on a big format, a 5-4 preferably. I mean, that picture of Coronation, 1937, is on a 5-4 plate, therefore you can pick a little bit out and pull it right up. And you don't lose definition. I mean, that's pin sharp. He used a Leica, but didn't like the resulting effect of trying to enlarge a picture and getting grain. That, to him, was an anathema. After the war, he used Rollies, 2¼ square, roll film. And then after that, the Hasselblad with all the lenses stuck on the front of it, and that was all the pictures. Most of the pictures you see after the war almost certainly would have been Rolly or Hasselblad. But he was still working up to not long before he died for the Observer, doing football behind the goal at Spurs or Stamford Bridge or Arsenal. And he still used his camera that his father gave him when he finished his apprenticeship in the 20s with a plate. And he still used that camera because that was the one that I could do the best work behind the goal. Interesting, isn't it? Horses for courses, cameras for jobs. And I remember the Hasselblad that he had. He always had one magazine that was black and white, one black magazine which was colour. And if he took a shot with you now, there'd be a black and white one, and there will be a colour one. So, you know, there was, and that would have been in the late 50s, 60s. But yeah, he liked the big format because you could get it all in and you could get it spot accurate. He didn't like the grainy bits, which, and a lot of people have been very successful because their style suits that. But if you think of some of his photography before the war, of harvest scenes or hop pickers, it wouldn't suit a 35mm format, because by the time you sort of wanted to see what it looked like, you'd lost definition. That suits totally different things. So what you're doing, he matched the camera to what he wanted. During the war, of course, he used an army issue camera, and didn't make any comment. I've got no comment about that. Don't think he was highly impressed with them, because Americans were all using speed graphics with flash and all the rest of it, and I don't think they certainly didn't have anything like an X-Acta camera or something.
You mentioned he used his gun once. Mm-hmm. During the war, but presumably he saw his role as a photographer rather than
a soldier. I mean, whether he'd have used it to in an emergency, I know not. But the only time he told me that the only time he'd used it was everybody was firing up to the tower in Notre Dame, and he thought, well, I'll join in as well. That's what he said, and I've no reason to doubt that that's the way it was. I mean, you see pictures of him as they're going into Germany with the revolver on his hip. Um, Well, certainly a couple of questions about my experience of demobilisation. Well, it's not much time. He was early out. Give you in Berlin in 1945, when the Americans and the British and the Russians all met in Berlin, in the Alexanderplatz, there used to be a huge black market of flogging off whatever you had lifted from the Germans or anything else. And the Germans, the Russians would buy, the Americans were much luckier because they were close to Switzerland. They were on the Swiss border and were able to go across to Switzerland with dollars, buy watches in Switzerland and bring them up to Berlin and sell them to the Russians. The Russians only liked the watches that made a loud tick. They weren't keen on Rolex or Omega. They liked in the loud tick ones. But father brought home a watch which he bought off an American at the Alexanderplatz. Perhaps we've still got it. It's a Longines. And he brought it home in the peak of his cap because they were frisked. Careful, I think. Post-war career, well, we've talked about it. Views on Magnum? He certainly always looked at Magnum pictures, very much so, when they appeared in Life or National Geographic or wherever Magnum sold their stuff, Parry Match, always looked at with interest. And if I say knew them all, he would indicate that he'd met Capper and Rogers, their names, that, you know, they're there somewhere. Of course, terrific set of pictures. Photographers in Korea, he was pleased that Ronnie Noble did so well as the BBC's cameraman in Korea, because of that picture in 1940 of young Ronnie. He was only a lad in those days, but the harem scare him, I believe. I don't know what happened to him after, during and after the war, but I remember my father saying, well, he's made a name for himself, you know, because they were the first television. Vietnam, didn't mention it. He died in 1970. Of course, Vietnam had been going on. I think he really didn't want to know going into a shooting. I know he didn't want to know to go into a shooting zone. And really, the Vietnam War in England doesn't mean half as much, anywhere near as much as the Americans. And we really largely ignored it. It didn't hit the fan unless there was something of note. Was he aware that his wartime work was preserved by the Imperial War Museum? I have no idea at all. No idea whatsoever.